Welcome to episode 23 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Stephanie Roy, who's a partner in our telecom, internet, and media practice, by our regular Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Our guest today, I'm really excited about, is Congressman Mike Pompeo, who came to Congress in 2010 with a remarkable background. He was first in his class at West Point, a cavalry officer patrolling the Iron Curtain until Soviet Union gave up. So he went to law school to see if he could find appropriate opponents. He was editor of the Law Review, and after getting his law degree, wisely chose to go into business instead, and founded Thayer Aerospace, providing components for commercial and military aircraft, then became president of Century International, an oil field equipment manufacturing, distribution, and service company. And then, if that wasn't enough, I'm tired already, he decided to run for Congress in 2010. He's on two major committees, Energy and Commerce and the House Intelligence Committee, which is how I came to know him. Mike, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you today, Stuart.
Thanks for coming on. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and currently holding the record for returning to Steptoe and Johnson to practice law the most number of times. So let's get started. We're going to put this week in NSA toward the end of the news roundup so that Congressman Pompeo can weigh in on it. So I'm going to start instead with the right to be forgotten. Google has begun taking requests to forget certain links. They've got 40,000 at last count, but I'm sure it's higher than that because since that count was made, I've submitted four. My theory on this is that if we want to know how dumb this right to be forgotten is, we need to actually try out the right. And since there's an online form and you can make as many requests as you like, I thought I'd put in four to see just how dumb this right was going to turn out to be. I've asked Google to ban a link to a book on the theory that it inaccurately described my winning the Privacy International title worst public official. Not that they didn't give me the title, but they never gave me the trophy, and the description of how I won it is inaccurate. So I'm just trying to get the book taken off of Google. I threw a fit over two photos. One I claimed was outdated because I don't have a beard anymore. We'll see if you can get links taken down just because you've changed your beard. And I also claimed for another link that I've lost weight since that photo was taken, and you know, I don't think that you know, this search engine should make me look fat. And finally, I've just I found the people whose links to me are most hateful and highest ranking, and just suggested that they're inappropriate because they say mean things about me personally, and I should control the information that is on the internet about me, and therefore it's inappropriate for those links to be up. We'll see whether any of those appallingly stupid reasons to censor the internet survive Google's review. And I'm encouraging everybody who listens to this to go online to the form and fill it out and try to take down one of your links. Use a google.co.uk search engine to find the link to make sure it's accessible from the European Union, and then pick a dumb reason and see if either Google or the data protection authority they refer it to upholds your request. The most most egregious takedown request that is granted will win a special award, special edition of our privies for privacy law abuses.
Hey, Stuart, I don't know. I think at least three out of those four reasons are pretty good ones. At least I'd like to take advantage of them at some point, given my frequent changes in hairstyle.
You take a beard, you take your beard, you put your beards on and take them off every 3 months, don't you?
Yeah. And the John Holmes mustache once in a while too. But, I have a serious question for you. Did the form require any indication of, the fact that you might be a European resident, or is that considered irrelevant now to Google?
It asked what jurisdiction I wanted to make the request under. But it did not ask that I be a resident of that jurisdiction. And so I think the theory is I get to – well, you know, the Europeans will tell you this is like the rights of man. Everybody in the world has special rights under European data protection law. So they could hardly say that they're not going to let Americans take advantage of this. Google.com won't be censored, at least for now, but Google.co.uk will be, and .fr, and I think it can be at the request of anyone who thinks their personal data is inaccurate or outdated or inappropriate.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard conflicting things from European lawyers. Some of them have looked at me with surprise when I suggested that anyone in the world could file a request to be forgotten. And others have said, no, you know, if you look at the law, just as you just said, if you look at the European directives, that they're not limited to European residents. So I think it's amazing that that's not clearly answered, that question. It seems pretty fundamental.
Yeah, I think Google may have decided not to try to constrain it in that way for fear that they would lose if challenged. But there's no doubt where I am, since I sent them a picture of my Virginia driver's license to prove my identity. So if they want to kick me out on that basis, I'll certainly report it when it happens. So I actually, speaking of interfering with free speech rights on the internet. Isn't there a cyberbullying case going up to the New York Court of Appeal on the grounds that you can't say mean things online about certain people?
Yeah, there was a conviction under the cyberbullying law in New York of a 15-year-old who created a Facebook page in which he flamed other teenagers by posting photos of them that had captions that included very graphic and sexual comments about the other people. And he was charged under the law, and now the constitutionality of that law is before New York's highest court. And the law is really broadly worded. It prohibits communicating private, personal, false, or sexual information intended to harass, annoy, threaten, abuse, taunt, intimidate, torment, humiliate, or otherwise inflict significant emotional harm on another person. That's pretty broad. I mean, you take the sexual stuff out of it, you take the intimidation or threatened stuff out of it, and, you know, you're looking at communications of a private nature intended to harass someone. You know, I get emails like that every day and probably send a couple as well. So, you know, I'd be shocked if this law were upheld. And when you get First Amendment cases like that, you know, courts can strike them down as facially overbroad, because even if they're not unconstitutional as applied to the particular case, the fact that the law is so broadly written has a chilling effect on other speech. So it may well be stricken down as facially unconstitutional.
Well, even if they do it as applied, I mean, so he uses graphic sexual language to abuse and torment other teenagers. Is there anybody who's been to high school who hasn't already experienced that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I don't know how courts would look at this, because the courts have upheld discipline by schools for this type of conduct in the school setting. And I think that's comes under the rubric of school administrators' broad authority to ensure good discipline and part of their pedagogical mission in a school. But if it's happening outside of school, I think there's legitimate questions about whether that's lawful.
All right. Well, so it'll be argued and decided probably not in, in the next few months, but what, maybe 3, 4, 6 months, something like that?
Yeah, I would expect either very end of this year or beginning of next year.
Another really interesting development, although it's more technical than legal, is that Google has begun naming companies that don't use SSL to encrypt their link to their subscribers. That's clearly a naming and shaming exercise, because Google has been doing this for a year or more, it seems to be working. At least one provider of email services has already begun or announced it's beginning SSL right after being named. And this is part of an effort to make it harder for governments to intercept communications. That won't have an impact on the 702 program or U.S. government or the law enforcement efforts to get access to Gmail or Hotmail directly from Google or from Microsoft. But another thing that Google is doing will, they've come up with a an extension for Chrome that automatically encrypts your emails end-to-end, which means that it's sitting in your email inbox encrypted, and it's only decrypted when it gets to your computer. If that catches on, and Google's doing its best to make it very easy, it'll have two effects. First, it cuts off Google's access to information, which would seem to be inconsistent with their business interest, but they're apparently willing to take that hit in order to deny even the U.S. government access to those communications, which is what this will do. They said, and maybe this is how they reconcile the two interests, they said, well, we don't think people will do this all the time just for particularly sensitive emails, but my guess is they'll do it for criminal emails first, which means that the government is going to lose a lot of access to criminal communications or national security sensitive communications, but for ordinary things like airline reservations, Google and Google Now will still be able to use the content to send you reminders or advertisements. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it works, but it's a sign of just how determined U.S. tech companies are to really do damage to the National Security Agency and the other U.S. government agencies that they see as having done real damage to them. And in a similar indication of just how bad things have gotten, U.S. Marshals actually went out and seized records from Florida law enforcement agencies because there was an open records request by the ACLU to see those records. This has to do with a particular technology involved. It's called a stingray. Michael, did you dig into that?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the ACLU has been trying to get information from the feds and from state and local law enforcement about their use of stingray through various means. And a stingray, just to back up for a second, it's basically a law enforcement tool to simulate a cell phone tower and to trick nearby mobile devices to connect with them and thereby reveal their location. So by moving stingrays around, law enforcement can triangulate them and really locate a person with pretty great accuracy. And so they use this to track down suspects. And the ACLU has raised concerns that in many cases government is using these things without a search warrant, even though it's basically being used as a location device for which a search warrant is typically required. And in this case, they sought records under state Freedom of Information Act. And before the Sarasota Police Department could turn them over, the U.S. Marshals moved in and said, hey, we own these records because the deputy that was employing the stingray was actually deputized by us. So he was effectively serving as a U.S. Marshal. So they're not subject to disclosure under Florida law. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
So is there a difference between knowing somebody's location right now and tracking him from a constitutional point of view? Do you, I gather that, after Jones, there's a pretty good argument that you need, a warrant to track somebody.
Law enforcement is generally, when they've used a tracking device, they've generally gotten a search warrant because the tracking device can follow someone into private spaces. Under existing jurisprudence, to track someone in public spaces generally doesn't require a warrant. After U.S. v. Jones, though, I think you've got a majority of justices who say if you track someone over an extended period of time, even in public spaces, that may well constitute a search under the Fourth Amendment and therefore require a warrant. But that remains to be decided since the court decided Jones on a much narrower ground involving the physical trespass on a car. It also remains undecided whether you need a warrant to get cell site location data from a cell phone provider, because there's the theory under Smith v. Maryland that information is held by a business. It's basically non-content information, and so you can get it with something short of a warrant. So all of that still remains to be decided. One of the more interesting things about stingrays that I've read, another town in Florida, I think it was Tallahassee, admitted that for, I think since 2010, they've been using a stingray without any court order on the grounds that they had a non-disclosure agreement with the company that makes stingrays, which the city said basically prevented them from revealing records to a court. Which is, if that's accurate, it's pretty astounding that a non-disclosure agreement can interfere with your legal obligations.
Yeah, that's that doesn't sound like it's likely to stand up. And the ACLU is all over this. They've probably got an entire stingray litigation department now. I have to say, I think the court is going to regret the door opening in Jones, because there just must be two dozen fact patterns and cases that could arise, technologies that tell you something about somebody's location. And once they start saying, something other than the narrowest decision, which was about intrusion on private property, as soon as they start saying something else is the case and that your location by itself is constitutionally protected, they're in for a generation of fine-tuning and distinctions that they're going to have to draw, and they're never going to find a satisfying place to stand.
That's right. And the reasoning of the five justices in Jones was based on how long the tracking occurred. And I think, as Scalia pointed out in a separate opinion, where do you draw the line? Is 4 weeks of tracking too much, but 2 weeks is okay, and you don't need a search warrant for that? How many days exactly makes it somehow constitutionally protected? That's a much fuzzier line than even the line of fetal viability in abortion cases, which is a moving target. There's a lot of guidance that they're going to have to give through just case after case.
Yeah, I did see some academic research looking at the patterns that we follow in our locations, which claimed that a week was about enough. These are computer scientists trying to play constitutional lawyers and saying that once you get up to a week, you can tell an enormous amount about people. You probably could have guessed that, because you'd say what we do on Sundays tends to be different from what we do on Monday through Friday. But I'm not sure that their analysis of these records shows much more than that. But that's the kind of facts that are going to be put forward to the court, and I just think they're going to hate what they've started with this. Let me change direction here and talk about something that we haven't discussed before, which is Google and Facebook both, and maybe others, I heard Airbus at one point, have begun exploring the idea not just of using drones or balloons, but also of launching an entire suite of satellites to provide internet access for the other 3 billion. In fact, the company that I think Google bought is O3B, standing for other 3 billion. The prices of the this investment are in the billions themselves, but they're not what Iridium paid when Iridium when Motorola launched Iridium, and we did the legal work back in the 90s or the 80s.
Just wait till they go bankrupt and buy them for $25 million.
Well, that did happen to our client.
Exactly.
Yes, it's true. Stephanie's here, and I thought it would be useful just to ask, what are the legal issues and regulatory issues surrounding the idea of just launching satellites and starting to give the world the internet service?
It depends on what frequencies you want to do it with. The venture that was in the press last week on Google, they're looking at frequencies that were allocated, that were in Ka band, that venture called Teledesic was going to...
They were a launch.
Exactly. That folded in 2002 because of financial issues. And that is a lot of companies in the 1990s did the heavy lift at the International Telecommunication Union to get certain frequencies allocated for low Earth orbit constellation use, which is what this the proposed system by Google would be and what these other systems would be. The advantages, of course, of low Earth orbit constellations is much lower latency, much smaller satellites. You have much better coverage of the Earth.
I always thought it was cool. Basically, those low Earth orbit satellites are just like mobile, except that the switch is always moving and the subscriber effectively is standing still.
Right, right. And the technology advanced considerably over the course of the 1990s. The funny thing is, in the beginning of the 1990s, when Iridium first announced its plans, people poo-pooed it from not a business perspective, but from a technological perspective. They proved them wrong. In the inter-satellite system links and everything proved quite doable and actually has advanced considerably since then. But it was the business, you know, case that fell through the floor.
It was eaten by GSM.
That's right. Which harmonization. Yeah,
exactly. You could take a GSM phone anywhere, which wasn't true when the Iridium project
when they started, launched. Right. I mean, and businessmen were no longer willing to pay $4 a minute for a satellite telephone call because they could get it on their terrestrial system instead. So if you're talking about a frequency band that you want to communicate in that has not been kind of established and allocated at the International Telecommunication Union, you need to go through a regulator that knows how to get that done at the ITU, which is what Teledesic and Iridium did in the 1990s in the United States, and that was a big part of their legal, you know, regulatory costs. If you go through one that's already been coordinated at the ITU, you don't need to go through a big, expensive system like the United States. Google, for example, is going through the Channel Islands, Isle of Jersey, which actually coordinates through the ITU through Ofcom, the UK entity. And they have a very streamlined process for this, and they don't actually have individual satellite licensing per se. They'll coordinate with and notify with to the ITU for you. And then what you're left with is procuring landing rights in the relevant jurisdictions. And these systems are not interested in landing rights in the United Kingdom, France, Germany, United States. They're interested Malaysia, sub-Saharan Africa.
Those are landing in the sense that they're going to put the stuff
right
into onto the ground and then transmit it on wire.
Well, what they're going to do is probably, you know, the equivalent of the telephone booth where the village can come and use the telephone, the internet booth.
Oh, but that's okay. So that's the uplink.
That's the uplink and the downlink. Well, the downlink too.
Oh, the downlink too.
They're probably downlink too. We're not. They're at the first instance. They're probably not talking ubiquitous handheld mobile devices. Probably talking about fixed service. Which is so basic, internet connectivity to cells of unserved geography. And so, you know, you can, if you use coordinated spectrum, feasibly much lower cost, of course, than it was, 20 years ago.
That's very interesting, the old systems all had downlink so that it could hook up to the wired network for communications because it was faster and cheaper, and they'd used as little of the satellite capacity as possible. That still may be attractive.
It depends upon what the infrastructure is in the area that they're landing. What they're talking about is going to pretty much the unserved portions of the globe. That's their next big market. It eventually is going to be their market.
Aren't the satellites have to be over the United States? Don't they? Low Earth orbit, they cross the U.S. just to say, and when they're over the U.S., they're not serving sub-Saharan Africa. Why would they?
No, but they orbit the Earth every 90 minutes in low Earth orbit just to maintain their orbit. So they'll pick an inclination, and orbital plane kind of configuration that is best serves probably equatorial regions predominantly.
Right, okay. But still, I would think at some point they're over countries that are well-developed.
True. Yes.
And they're not doing anything if they aren't communicating to those countries, right?
That's right. They won't need anything from those countries as long as they're not uplinking or downlinking.
To do it, yes.
So
for example, there might be some locations in rural or mountainous areas of developed worlds that they
Do they need a Tanzanian license to provide internet service in Tanzania?
They need the equivalent of what we would call landing rights to uplink and downlink from locations inside that country.
So here's a question to bring this back to what our podcast usually talks about. Does that mean that governments can say to Google and Facebook and whoever else does this, you can have landing rights when you show us how you're going to allow us to intercept and decrypt all of these communications?
Theoretically, yes. Yeah. Depends on what their infrastructure is.
They better figure that out before they've spent $3 billion.
There's a lot of things, and we're talking about services that are probably not well developed or well defined in these countries too. So it'll probably be a different approach that they have to apply and pursue in each country.
Wow. Okay. Well, this is going to be interesting. And people are mostly saying this is economically feasible, even though you're not going to be providing a lot. You're not going to get a lot of revenue out of this. Although I suppose people could sign up for, my ISP is in the sky, right?
Right. And I think it's a long-term strategy by these companies.
Just to make sure that they have delivered content to all these folks and they'll worry about making money off it later.
I believe so. It's a upfront capital investment.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you, Stephanie. That was, we're going to watch that. So let us know how that goes.
It's an exciting time. I feel like back 20 years ago when we were first talking about Iridium and Teledesic and all the other.
And I remember that.
Systems.
And the by far the biggest expense there other than the actual physical launches and the satellites was the regulatory cost because every single country had to approve it and everyone had to have it explained to them and you sent lawyers out to all these countries and you talk. It was
nobody had ever seen it before.
Yeah.
At least this time hopefully some people somewhere have seen it once before. So maybe that'll work in favor.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to this week in NSA. Two short items. Germany, after the German prosecutors saying they weren't going to open a case to prosecute people for going after Angela Merkel's phone, have announced that they are investigating presumably NSA for surveillance. I can't help noting that it was about a year and a half before Angela Merkel complained about her phone being tapped by NSA, that she complained about her computer having been hacked by the People's Liberation Army of China. Criminal investigation of China is still awaiting action at the Justice Department, so apparently they're only investigating and trying to prosecute allies rather than actual communists of the sort that she claims the NSA surveillance reminds her of. NSA won the Justice Department, won a decision late last week. There has been a long back and forth, sows your mother kind of fight with EFF, which filed a case in, I think, 2006, claiming that something that NSA was doing was illegal, and got a an order saying don't destroy any evidence, and then later claimed that that meant that they could override all of NSA's rules for getting rid of data that they didn't need to prevent unnecessary intrusions into people's privacy. They claimed that somehow this was evidence of wrongdoing, but there was never any particularly clear claim of what the wrongdoing that this might be evidence of was. And the Justice Department was told they had to destroy it by the FISA court. Then the FISA court said, well, maybe the judges who are hearing this case have a different view. After presenting evidence to the court that issued the original order, Justice Department got determination that it did not need to stop destroying evidence, basically by saying these are big, complicated systems. We have automated and very aggressively enforced rules for destroying evidence, and if you try to say, wait a minute, hold up there. It's like stopping the Indianapolis 500 mid-race and expecting people to stop on, you know, in 30 yards and then hoping that nothing bad happens. And the court said, you know, I'd just as soon you didn't do that. So that's a kind of modest victory for NSA and the Justice Department in what will be an endless litigation. But the most important and interesting thing that happened in NSA's world was the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on the USA Freedom Act. If you remember, that's the act that came out of the House about 300 to 100. It ends bulk collection. It imposes a sort of specific selection term requirement on national security searches so that the national security agencies and the FBI cannot get data under those authorities unless they use a specific selection term such as person or entity or account or device or address. That was a last minute compromise between the Intelligence Committee that Representative Pompeo serves on and the Judiciary Committee in the House, and then a later manager's amendment that was brokered, I think, by House leadership. I didn't think the Senate much liked the bill when they saw it, or at least the Senate Intelligence Committee, but I thought it might be worth drawing Mike Pompeo into the conversation to talk a little bit about how the bill got put together and how it happened to get 300 votes, even after about half the original sponsors jumped off the bill because it didn't go far enough.
Well, you bet. I appreciate a chance to sort of talk about how the bill came into its current form, as passed by our body, at least. So there are a wide range of views on Section 215 and all the various pieces of it. I think for your listeners, it's important to realize, right, this thing's been around a long time. There's a lot of history to this. And we all have to take a step back. Those of us who sort of live in this world have to acknowledge that this has been out there for now a long time. And these practices are well developed. Members of Congress, some of whom now feign ignorance, have known about this for a long time. Mr. Snowden did what he did, some of these members of Congress said, oh, goodness, I didn't know, when in fact they did. And we've also had members of Congress talk about the fact that the government is reading vast amounts of their emails and listening to vast amounts of their telephone calls, which, of course, you know, Stuart, and I know not to be true. And so it is into that political space that we find this conversation, this political outcome that we got from the USA Freedom Act, all the changes that we made. And so the Judiciary Committee had a different view. There were a number of folks who had voted for an amendment to an earlier piece of legislation that would have completely eliminated Section 215. And so what you saw here was a solution that we could get 300 votes for, that it may be the case ultimately that a Democrat-controlled Senate and the White House can ultimately support as well, which in my judgment does in fact keep in place the most important pieces of the NSA's capacity to do what it was doing, which was trying to keep Americans safe, both those of us here in the homeland and our folks fighting abroad as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We should probably take a back up. The program was started because of problems in the 9/11 attacks when the government, when NSA intercepted calls to a Yemen safe house that came from San Diego, and they knew they were going to a Yemen safe house, but they didn't know they were coming from San Diego, which was highly relevant information because one of the guys on the calls ended up piloting one of the planes struck the World Trade Center. So it would have been a very nice thing to know he was in the United States, and NSA didn't have that capability. They decided that the best way to get that information was to get all of the call to and from data in the United States and put it in a database and then protect it from search with a variety of privacy restrictions. But as you say, it's very easy to hit that program on the ground that my call data has been seized by NSA. It's been grabbed by the government. The government now has all my data, and I resent it. And so the fact that the data was in government hands as opposed to telephone company hands turned out to be a major talking point for people who are unhappy with the program. And this bill does away with that and essentially says, if you want this data, you need to get it from the telephone companies. I testified on Thursday to the Senate Intelligence Committee about this, and I thought they were quite skeptical. There were a group of traditional national security Republicans who liked the old program, but there were also a number of middle-of-the-road Democrats or Republicans from Angus King of Maine to Senator Feinstein to Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, all people who are not, who are really in the center of the Senate to the extent that there is a center, and they all expressed kind of doubts about this. Some of them were worried about the fact that they couldn't tell how long the data was going to be held by the phone companies, and they didn't know how good a job the phone companies would do of securing either the data or the government's search terms. That argument must have come up in the House, but I assume that it was simply a non-starter in the House to leave this data in NSA's hands.
It did come up. I talked with lots of folks, and you, Stuart, you and I have talked about this before. We both care deeply about protecting Americans' privacy. It's important. We've got to do that well. And so this issue, I call it a technical issue about where is this data most safe? Where is there the most oversight? Where is the most capacity for transparency? Is it to have the data in the hands of the government, or is it some third party holding place? We've seen what happens with disclosures from third party private companies, right? They make mistakes from time to time, and this data gets out. And so there was a long discussion about it, but at the end of the day, the will of the body was that we didn't want this data in the hands of government. And so we'll attack it from a different perspective. And I hope what we haven't lost in this, Stuart, is the capacity, A, to be responsive. That is, it is often the case that this information is needed in a very, very timely fashion. I hope we haven't lost that. We've spent a lot of time with the NSA. I think they're convinced that they can mostly do what they did before in that sense. But second, I hope we haven't lost the capacity to have oversight, because I think that oversight component is incredibly important as well. So I hope by taking it out of the hands of the folks at NSA who provided lots of oversight to members of Congress for decades, we haven't lost the ability to see that. I reminded folks, Stuart, if you get rid of the Section 215 edifice, the structure, it doesn't mean these programs go away. Right? Presidents did this before with no statutory support, right? The entire reason for the creation of this was to create another institution. In this case, Article I institution, to have oversight of these programs. And so it's my responsibility to do that oversight. I think we've done it well, and I hope that we still continue to have this passage so that executives don't behave improperly and that there's another institution checking that power.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely the case that the oversight edifice that has been built with access by the whoever's in the minority as well as whoever's in the majority to all of the programs, often on a very bipartisan basis, as well as the courts, as well as the various inspectors general and privacy officers in the intelligence community. It's a very robust and kind of multifaceted oversight regime that people have been determined to deprecate in an effort to get rid of this program. But I agree with you. It's very hard to see, apart from just exposing all our intelligence programs, how we could improve the oversight in an effective way. And this one really just moves the oversight of the privacy impact of these records back to the phone companies and says, you do whatever is commercially reasonable to protect those records.
That's right. In some sense, likely a denigration of their capacity to know precisely who's looking at what.
So one of the things that also I thought bothered the Senate, maybe I'm kidding myself, but it certainly bothered me, and I thought they were nodding when I complained about this, is these specific selection terms. You know, they sound like they're pretty comprehensive. You can tell the company to search their records by name or entity or address, by device, by account. But I gave an example. I said, well, suppose that you get word, as we did with Zazi, the guy who wanted to blow up the tunnels in New York, that he's out buying beauty supplies so he can get acetone to build bombs. And you want to go to a bunch of beauty supply shops in Denver, which is where he was buying it, and ask them, has anybody bought unusual quantities of acetone-containing beauty products? Well, that's not on the selection list. That's a product request. And so if this law is applied strictly, I'm not sure that that kind of a request could be made under national security law.
Well, it's interesting. Well, I suppose we'll have to see how it develops in terms of how it develops under national security law, but the example you give, I think, does highlight another thing that I hope Americans come to understand as well, which is that in some sense we are moving to a place where we're providing terrorists more rights than we do folks here in the United States. That very same information about who bought a particular product at a particular store is very likely to be able to be obtained under domestic investigation tools.
Those tools, yes, they're used every week.
All the time by beat cops everywhere and by sheriffs and all kinds of places.
Yeah, it is very strange. I think it reflects in part an understandable suspicion of the intelligence agencies. We all know police officers. We've all been victims of crime. We all want the police officers to succeed. We haven't, that we know of, all been victims of, you know, aggression by foreign nations or terrorist attacks. And so there's an inclination to view the intelligence community as completely other and therefore more dangerous and more suspicious than the FBI or police agencies. And that probably accounts for part of this.
Is both the work done is performed by and the benefits received by our folks in the Department of Defense, whether that is the DIA itself or service members who work at various intelligence organizations. You have lots of uniformed military personnel, active duty folks and reservists alike, trying to help keep America safe through its intelligence collection operations. And that gives, I think when I tell folks that, they're surprised. They have a different image of who these people are. And when they do that, they know these folks, right? It's their brothers, it's their cousins, it's their friends. Certainly in a place like Kansas, we all know lots of folks who are serving in the military. And when you begin to know who these people are, much like you talked about knowing your local policeman, I think it begins to put a different face on what it is these folks are really trying to do and brings you back to that core idea that these are part of an important effort to keep Americans safe.
Yeah, you know, I go out to NSA still a fair amount, and you go into the cafeteria, and you get a remarkable cross section of people. There's lots and lots of people in uniform. There's people in standard bureaucratic dress, ties, and sport coats, and there's a fair number of people with dyed pink streaks in their hair. So it's a much more diverse workforce than the American people really understands.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So did you actually see NSA product when you were out patrolling the Iron Curtain?
You know, the truth is, I don't know. We certainly received lots of intelligence now, having a chance to have seen it from the other end of the pipe. I suspect that we probably did. It was presented to us in a format that we would not have known necessarily the source, but I'm guessing that some of the very information we relied on to know what folks were doing came from the NSA.
So before we move on, I just thought I'd ask one question. I got the impression that while some of the Senate Intelligence Committee members thought they needed to move quickly on USA Freedom, it seems to me that the dynamic here, with all these doubts and uncertainties and very diverse views, makes it a little unlikely that they will move quickly. And I wondered whether the House sees this as a bill that has to be passed this year, or is it possible that this will all be kicked to the next Congress when we have a deadline of June of 2015 for Section 215 to be reauthorized? But I'm not sure I see a deadline that requires the bill to be reported back to conference this year.
I think that's true. I think there's nothing that this isn't one of the half a dozen things that is a must-pass piece of legislation for this year. Having said that, I hope the Senate will consider it in pretty short order and bring it forward. Senator Feinstein has indicated that she wants to do that. And so I hope that they do. I hope that we now, having done our work here, albeit imperfect, I think we've got a solution that is workable both for protecting American privacy and for providing the national security needs that we have. And I'd love to see it done this year so that there's no need to go revisit that and reopen some of these very challenging issues in the winter or spring of next year.
Yeah, it's the idea that this will be decided in some spasm on May 30th is a little scary, too.
It is. Precisely right, sir. This is complex. There are competing interests here. There are very different divergent political views, so it's something that needs to be done in due course, right, with consideration and a little bit of thoughtfulness, not, oh, my goodness, we've got to get something done by next Tuesday. That would be a very bad way to conduct national security policy.
So we got into this mess because of Edward Snowden's disclosures, and I routinely ask the audiences I speak to vote up or down, Snowden good or Snowden bad, and the bad almost always outnumbers the good, but sometimes it's close, and sometimes it's 2-1. He's not the most popular guy in all of America, but he certainly has people who are very supportive of him. Have you gotten developed a view of Edward Snowden based on both your experience in the case and what you've seen from the National Security Agency about what he took?
I have. View him as one of the single greatest traitors to American national security in an awfully long time. The materials that he released, 90+% is the unclassified number, were a core Department of Defense secrets, kinds of things that families should know their young men and women who are serving are less safe as a direct result of that. And I understand the Russian Greenwald propaganda machine has not presented those. The things that have been trotted out in front of the American people have been about some of the more difficult things that we've just been talking about. But the bulk of what Snowden did was just plain old ordinary military stuff. And we're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of money keeping our armed services safe, and they will lose their capacity to perform their missions as a direct result of what Mr. Snowden did. I have no doubt about that.
He's been very coy about what he took. He says, I didn't take $1.7 million, but he really didn't rule out the possibility he took $1.6 million, which was, I think, the latest estimate that I saw in the newspapers. He, when asked, well, did you take military stuff? He says, well, look at what's been published. You haven't seen any military stuff published, which is not quite the same as denying that he took it. So, given how close he sails to the wind with his statements, I kind of think that's a confirmation that he did take a lot of military stuff.
Yeah, I can confirm for you here. He absolutely took the majority of what he took. 90%+ of what he took was military stuff. I understand why the American people haven't had a chance to see that yet. I hope that we can begin to communicate that, because it's important, not just because it tells you who Snowden is, but because it tells you a little bit more about the kinds of things America needs to do to make sure this never happens again. I mean, whatever you think of Snowden, there was also an enormous failure for the institution to protect its own data, and we've got to fix that as well.
Oh, yeah, that was disastrous.
Right.
Disastrous. Yeah. That is interesting. I have started to develop a working theory that he took that stuff so that he could bargain for his safety. He probably originally thought he was going to bargain with the Hong Kong / Chinese government. He may have bargained with the Russians. He's offered, some of this stuff to, I think, the Brazilians and maybe the Germans if they would give him, asylum. But I kind of suspect this was his plan all along. I'll take all this stuff because I can, and then I'll separate it from the scandal stuff, and I'll use it to make sure that I'm safe. If worse comes to worse, I'll negotiate with the U.S. government and give it back to them, or at least tell them what I took, if they'll give me a plea bargain.
Yeah, so it wouldn't surprise me that was at least part of it. It may also be the case that it was just a snatch and grab.
Yeah.
So he took what he could and didn't know what he had until he'd taken it all. And that could also be at least part of it. But what we know is that there's every reason to believe that the materials that he took, all of them, are in the hands of people who are not friends of the United States of America. And that right. He knows that, and he provided that to them. And from my perspective, whatever it is we may have learned about the Section 215 program that the American people now want to know, it is far outweighed by the damage that Mr. Snowden has done to keep America safe.
So it would be really ironic if this apostle of targeted intelligence gather an opponent gathering and a opponent of mass collection of data just grabbed all this stuff because he could, not because he should.
The irony is pretty thick.
Yeah. So how have you liked being on the Intelligence Committee? You came in without any idea what it really did. It's an interesting committee, but it's in many respects not the committee that most people aspire to. You can't stay forever. I wonder if it's lived up to your hopes for it.
I've thoroughly enjoyed my time. I hope I've contributed to our intelligence community's capacity to do their job. I wanted to do it because it brings me a little bit back to the world that I lived in for a short time while I was in the military. This effort to make sure that the federal government does its most important task, as outlined by the framers, to keep us all safe. So being able to be a part of that has been fantastic, to try and provide oversight, to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do well, that they have the resources to do what they're supposed to do well, and making sure they're not doing what they're not supposed to do either. And so to get a chance to meet these intelligence warriors has been great, to work with them, to make sure that the technology is as advanced as in their hands and they can do the things they need to do has really been a blessing for me. And I hope I have helped them a great deal also.
Yeah, it's having been on the executive branch side of that, having smart oversight committee members who care is just so valuable. They don't talk to outsiders much about what they do, and that's really a role that the oversight committees play. And they, if the oversight committee gets a briefing and says that is an enormous contribution to our security, It's really validation for what they do. And so I'm delighted you're engaged in it. So let me ask though, the other oversight issue that's, convulsing the community is this fight between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA over, ultimately a report on its torture, the torture allegations and the, harsh interrogation, methods that have been abolished for 6 years, but are still producing, acrimony, partly because the report, in its drafting might have, led the drafters to get access to information that the CIA thought they shouldn't have, and that led to a CIA investigation that the Senate Intelligence Committee thought went way too far. They characterized it as breaking into Intelligence Committee computers. Now we're waiting for the report. The House Intelligence Committee avoided all that. How did you manage not to get dragged into a similar fight?
I'm glad that we did, and I hope they figure it out over there too. This is an old battle, an old scar, predates my time, not only on the Intelligence Committee, but my time in Congress. About these issues around interrogations and when Congress was told. It's interesting to watch this issue come back now in the case of the release of the Gitmo 5, right, where, again, there was a statutory requirement for Congress to be notified. And so it may be the case that we end up heading down a similar path on that set of issues. It's a little different than the interrogation thing that Senator Feinstein and the White House are fighting about. From my perspective, I hope they get it figured out, but it has been fascinating to watch it play out in public because, right, this is an intra-party fight, right? Yeah. This is not a Republican angry at a Democrat president. This is a woman, a female senator who has done great work on national security. I wouldn't say that much from my perspective on the rest of her work as a senator, but on national security, she's been a stalwart trying to make sure we get it right. And to watch her have a fight with her own president, a president from her own party, I hope they can get figured out. It is not helpful to getting us back to the place where we're doing what it is we're supposed to do, providing that effective oversight we were talking about before.
Yeah, no, I've been on both sides of Senator Feinstein's very determined view of the world. She changing her mind is probably one of the toughest jobs I ever undertook, and I failed at it. This was not on a national security issue, but it was when I was at DHS. And there are some things that you're just not going to change your mind on. And interestingly, from her earliest time in government, she's been very supportive of anti-terrorism and law enforcement and the intelligence community. But on this issue, I think the CIA has run into her absolute determination that something was done wrong in those interrogation programs that hasn't yet been admitted, and she's not going to tolerate anybody getting in the way of releasing her detailed report about that. So you mentioned the release of the five Taliban leaders in exchange for Bo Bergdahl and the question of whether that was consistent with the statutory notice requirements. What's the likely fallout from that? How seriously is that going to damage what's already a pretty shaky relationship between the president and especially the House, but I think Senate as well? Do you have a feel for what it's going to mean long term?
Yes, sir. This may be the last question I have time for this morning, but I don't know how precisely that proceeds. I do know we're going to have hearings, that the Armed Services Committee is going to have hearings as well to try and understand why it is the case that we weren't provided simple notice. I understand it was controversial. There were lots of reasons, but we could certainly have been trusted to keep the information secret, and we probably would have objected. I know that I would have on the terms as I understand them now. But they would have still been permitted to proceed, even in spite of our objection. So to have not taken the simple task of having provided notice, I just find foolish and certainly unlawful. And so we're going to have discussions about it, where that proceeds. Only time will tell.
Well, thank you. I know we've come to the end of the time that we promised to get you out by. Congressman Mike Pompeo, member of the House Intelligence Committee and possessor of an all-star, actually three all-star careers as far as I can see, thank you so much for joining us. All right. And thanks to Stephanie, Michael, for joining us as well. Michael, before we sign off, do you have any upcoming speaking engagements that you want to talk about? Or have you written another book, grown another beard?
I'm speaking at the PLI Conference on Data Privacy and Security next Tuesday up here in New York, focusing on developments in litigation over the past year.
Great. I'm leaving straight from here to go speak at the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference, where I have since the 90s gone to twist their tail and mischievously contradict everything they stand for. It's been a long-term relationship. So I'm looking forward to talking about privacy as a moral panic. This has been episode 23 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vattis, Stephanie Roy, and especially Congressman Mike Pompeo. We hope you'll join us next week when we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.